Hi, and welcome to the AA Grapevine. I'm your volunteer reader, Shelley Miller. Today I'll be reading from the February 2025 issue of the AA Grapevine. This is part two for the month. In this segment, we will read a little bit about step two, tradition two, and hopefully get to a few personal stories. Let's get started. And our first story is about step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And it's entitled, A Little Faith. Because of his religious childhood, he had a hard time with step two, until he found that all he needed was willingness. I grew up on the poor side, in the middle class, in the Bible Belt. My family tree was full of ministers, choir leaders, and Sunday school teachers. And then there was me. It's not that I didn't like the idea of God, but I really didn't enjoy church. Based on what I heard, I was in store for some smiting, stoning, and maybe some fire and brimstone. At a very young age, I felt like a hypocrite as I sat in the pew with all these people in their Sunday best, and from what I could tell, pretending to have joy in their heart. As soon as the service ended, we got in the car and resumed life in the real world until we got dressed up the following Sunday. I assume this was true for everyone else in that church, too. As soon as I had some choice in the matter, I stopped going to church. Throughout my drinking, I made a few half-hearted attempts to go back to church, but nothing stuck. I even joined a church to save some tuition money on my kids' school. Plus, this other religious group had a drinking fraternity that I was looking to join. So why not? I said all the prayers, answered all the questions appropriately, and presto, I was in. But my motivation was wrong, and I got nothing more out of it than I put into it. My spiritual awakening began the day I came to, stumbled into the bathroom, and looked in the mirror to finally see my humiliating reflection. I was no longer able to filter out the reality from what I saw. That day I put on my cleanest dirty clothes, brushed my teeth, and went to work. I completed a few online questionnaires on whether I was an alcoholic drinker and read the opening paragraph to several articles on the subject, holding out hope that I would find the vindication I was desperately seeking. I did not. Everything I read confirmed what I didn't want to believe. So before the notion to do anything about it wore off, I went to a downtown noon meeting of AA. It was there, in that meeting, that I said for the first time out loud to myself or anyone else that I was an alcoholic. I felt a weight being lifted. I was in the right place. Right away, I identified as someone who had no control over alcohol, and it wasn't hard to admit that my life was exhaustingly unmanageable. Luckily, AA assured me that I didn't have to believe in the God of my childhood, and that I was free to believe in anything so long as it was not me. For me, the contradiction to that sentiment was that all the literature and the 12 steps still looked like they were written by someone with ecclesiastic turrets. The words God and Him are in the main part of the big book, 281 times. I was worried that I would again be building a life based on hypocrisy, and it scared me. I wanted what AA members had, but I didn't know if I could believe what they believed. When I took my second step with my sponsor, I leaned heavily on the willing to believe option that I was given. At best, I came to AA with a misunderstanding of God. It was explained to me that a big difference between belief and faith is that belief is based on a sort of blind trust in what I've been told by someone. Faith, however, is based on my experience and witnessing actual results. I wasn't asked to have faith in anything, just to be willing to believe. It was easy for me to believe that you all believed that this God character had done so much for you, and you couldn't do it for yourself. I believed you so much that I was willing to suspend my general disbelief and just do these seemingly silly formalities of talking to a higher power in prayer and meditation. I figured that if I saw anything like the results you all had, I might gain a little faith in the process, and that could work for me too. When I took my third step with my sponsor, I had a tougher go of it. The third step prayer was a bit more than I could say without feeling like a complete hypocrite. The words felt as hollow as I recited the prayers of my youth, not to mention the fact that it felt like a tongue twister with thee and thou all throughout. But the big book also says the wording is quite optional, if I can express the idea without reservation. At this point, I took it upon myself to come up with my own prayer that I could easily say every morning when I woke up, one I could say without reservation and in the belief that a higher power might hear it too. Hey God, if that's your real name, I prayed, please help me do your will today. And if I come up short, please don't come down too hard on me unless you think that it might help me. Amen. I would also end the day with, hey God, it's me again. Thank you for today and for helping me get back to bed sober. I hope I did okay today. If you want to keep working with me, I'll see you in the morning. Amen. These simple prayers made it easier and easier for a heathen like me to pray. When I stopped trying to define my higher power, it became even closer to me. Who is my higher power? I don't know, but it's a lot bigger than I can imagine. I will go ahead and call it Him and God because those words are easier to say and use. I talk to God quite often now throughout the day, and I occasionally remember to slow down and get quiet to see if there is a response I should be hearing. Mostly I hear advice like, how would you have handled this before? Well, don't do that. This foundation of a belief in something I didn't understand but stopped arguing about was enough to carry me through the rest of the steps. The process has been a spiritual awakening that continues to grow so long as I start off the day with the idea of not operating entirely on self-will and being willing to ask for a better will to follow. Signed, Patrick M. in College Park, Maryland. And now we'll move on to Tradition 2. Tradition 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. And this story is entitled Smooth Moves. A business meeting is a perfect place, he says, to round the edges, get along, and get the job done. Over the years in AA, I've developed a relationship with a power greater than myself. I've learned that this power is necessary for 24/7 sobriety. I've also found that there's no greater need for protection by God than at an AA business meeting. With all the interruptions, bluntness, and other verbal fisticuffs, AA business meetings can sometimes look more like a virtual saloon fight in a Western movie than a gathering of sober people coming to an agreement. I've heard it called rocks in a tumbler, which is a reference to people who form a group and work off the rough edges of each member's personality before normalizing and stabilizing as a group. However, it may be more useful to phrase it differently. We AAs need to work together or die alone, and the AA group is the perfect place to learn how to do this. Consider it a training ground for life. The group I belong to on Saturday morning is a big book step group, and it's full of people who are enthusiastic about AA and about our group. Many of us, me included, are still learning how to work together. During a virtual business meeting a while back, a motion was made to change what attendees recite at the end of our meeting from the Lord's Prayer to the Responsibility Declaration. The discussion that ensued was quite lively, to put it mildly. Our secretary struggled to maintain group decorum and order under what was then a still new digital format for the group to hold a business meeting. Fearing that they wouldn't be heard, impassioned members continually interrupted each other to state their reasons for or against this change. But our secretary's kind hand prevailed. Discussion was eventually completed and the motion was voted down. We returned to business as usual with a few rough edges removed. Was the hand of a loving higher power at work in the group and the members? Quite possibly yes, because despite the heated discussion and the pointed opinions that group members held, no one exited the meeting. I can see now that the hand of God is the glue that keeps members together in fair weather or foul. We can have the experience of working together and God can get us through it no matter what the situation. Even AA business meetings can be a safe place to be, and this is where the true ultimate authority exists for members on how to work together. We hang on until the edges get smoothed, and then we become each a valued part of the group. Once our corners are smoothed, as strange as it may sound, it may be time to move on in the spirit of rotation, to have a new experience, or to assist others to take their turn in the tumbler. My first real experience of being a group member was with this very group. I had some sharp opinions about running the group and picayune ideas about how the meeting format should be set, and yet it took a Herculean effort for me to speak up in the business meeting. I was so full of self and so self-conscious that expressing myself in front of the group for the first time made me feel like I was getting the dry heaves. And then there was the inevitable emotional hangover afterward. Should have said this and should have said that. But as they say, practice makes pretty good. Eventually, after a lot of practice sharing at a group meetings, I stopped beating myself up. I actually made sense in what I said to others without shouting or browbeating and started to be some kind of example for the newer members. Imagine that. More is to be revealed, as always, and one of the things I still struggle as I write this is the principle that no human power is in charge. I know this to be true intellectually, but my emotional side still has some past trauma or drama that is being worked out in the scenes in my subconscious. Part of me wants to put people on a pedestal and then treat the God of my understanding as just another Joe, and not really that all-powerful. Being able to recognize this limitation in my thinking is a fringe benefit of the steps. The solution to challenges like these always comes in ways I least expect, like seeking more spiritual growth and working with others. Here are some suggestions for personal behavior that I've found helpful at group conscious and business meetings. 1. Look for God first in the room. Ask God to be with me in the room. 2. Seek to understand rather than to be understood. And remember, what I really want doesn't matter, but what others want will help me to reach agreement. 3. Remember the step 10 code of love and tolerance. And 4. Be the best copy of the big book that I know how to be. These are goals and not my actual practice. In no way do I follow these perfectly, but when I falter, I get back up and start focusing on these 4, and as I do, everything seems to fall into place. And then truly, God does for me what I can't do for myself, especially when working with those who have the same alcoholic brain I do. Signed, George H. in Kingston, New Hampshire. And our next story is entitled Staying in the Game. Through years of challenges, he keeps showing up and he can't wait to see what's next. When I first came into the program, I knew nothing about AA. I did not go to detox or rehab. I came in off the streets. I was 28 and thought my life was over. I had never heard such raw and honest emotion as I did at those meetings. I started going to lots of meetings every week. I remember a lady about my age named Robin who had about 2 years more than me. She was one of those people who seemed to talk at every meeting. She shared about rage and God and the fact that she had MS. I stayed clear of her at first because that amount of anger is hard to be around. Amazingly, at 9 months sober, I too was diagnosed with MS. To say I was angry would be an understatement. Robin and I became friends. My friend Robin didn't walk with a cane or crutches. My MS, however, was very progressive. After just a few months, I started losing my cane and using crutches. And then I got a wheelchair. Around that time, one of my AA friends encouraged me to get involved with General Service to take my mind off myself. I got elected GSR for one of my groups. When I was 2 years sober, our area was having a General Service assembly, and I went. I used my wheelchair in public there for the first time. About 2 years after that, my friend Robin got married, and I attended her wedding in my wheelchair. At the wedding, she pulled me aside and told me she was upset that I had shown up in my wheelchair. She said she thought people would think she, too, would end up in a wheelchair. After that, our friendship faded away. About a year later, I moved to go to law school, and as my MS got worse, I was determined to see what I could do and could not do. At the end of my first year in law school, I went to another AA assembly. To my surprise, I was elected as the new literature chair. I got very busy and stayed sober all year. That year, I got a surprise call from my dad. He told me he had 30 days sober in AA. I was so happy. That began a 13-year journey of the two of us traveling across the U.S., going to AA conventions together. We became good friends. It was such a far cry from my days in high school when he would get a call from the police 2 or 3 times a month to come and get me out of jail for being drunk in public. He and I got a kick out of recalling those days. When my dad passed away, nothing was left unsaid between us. I eventually graduated law school, passed the California bar, and started my own law firm. A year later, my story was selected to be published in the Big Book. The years had passed and my MS got worse, but AA kept me sober. At 25 years sober, I lost the use of my left arm, so I went from a manual wheelchair to a power one. After another 9 years, I started losing use of my right arm. Contrary to what you might think, I'm okay most of the time. My sober life has been beyond my wildest dream. I'm 62 years old and 34 years sober now, and I'm still looking forward to tomorrow. I actually can't wait to see what happens next. Signed, RK in Benicia, California. And this next story is entitled, A Special Bond. 4 guys got sober together long ago, meet to talk, laugh, and yes, give each other a big hug. I went to lunch yesterday with 3 close AA friends at a trendy restaurant in Denver that was voted as having one of the best Philly steak sandwiches in town. The guys ranged in age from 64 to 94. We get together like this every few months, and when we're lucky, we're accompanied by a woman friend in the program who happens to be from my home state of Minnesota. But this day, it was just the guys. Our lunch was not that different from many previous ones. We enjoyed lots of laughter and stories from the past, traded stories of what our grown kids are up to, and discussed current events. However, this particular lunch had a deep and profound impact on me. I went to my first AA meeting in November of 1976. I was 20 years old at the time, and the meeting was for young people at a sober clubhouse in Minneapolis. People there were laughing, joking around, hugging, and at the end they all held hands and closed with a prayer. These people were nothing like me, and I wanted nothing to do with them. AA was not for me, I was sure. I managed to stay sober for 10 days straight, a record I had not achieved in several years. I don't remember how or why I started drinking again. I just remember the deep, dark cliff my life went down over the next couple of months. After an arrest, my 4th, in January of 1977, I found a little humility or humiliation and sought help. I went back to AA and have not had a drink since. I found out that those people were just like me and they would be central to my recovery. Okay, let's get back to our lunch yesterday. It dawned on me as we left that all 4 of us hugged each other in the middle of a very busy restaurant. I didn't give it a second thought at the time, but what a shift this was from how I thought back in 1976. It made me grateful to reflect on how much AA has changed me over the last 46 years. I also thought about how much more I want to change. Each one of these guys has something I want. It happened to be President's Day that day, so I asked which president they respected the most. Our 94-year-old friend told us his favorite, based on positive messages he's always communicating during his presidency. There was no talk of politics at our table. This inspired me to focus more on the good things instead of our differences. Another fellow inspires me with his tireless dedication to others and how he is taking action every day related to his AA service positions. The third friend, a fellow Minnesotan, started playing hockey when he turned 50. He's now 64 and still plays a pickup game on a regular basis. I admire his zest for life. I appreciate my friends. Each of them contributes to life and inspires others. They certainly inspire me. I'm so grateful for them. Together, we've learned to give hugs and to be hugged, no matter where we are. Signed, Gary C. in Arvada, Colorado. This next story is entitled, A Second Chance. Mom went to all the kids' games all right with a flask. Luckily, AA helped her win their love back. When I was first advised that I needed to put AA ahead of my children's extracurricular activities and family events, that going to an AA meeting was more important than going to my son's soccer game, I thought, No, I can't do that. The kids will be so disappointed if I'm not there. They will think I don't care. I had believed that I was doing a good job of hiding my drinking from my children. I thought they didn't know the extent of my disease. But the truth was is I had become an embarrassment to my children. They didn't know if I was going to smell like alcohol, stumble in the stands, or cheer too loudly from the sidelines. By the time I truly surrendered to this disease, my children had lost all respect and wanted nothing to do with me. They didn't care if I was at their events. The amount I drank at my children's activities evolved slowly as my disease tightened its grip. It began with sharing a bottle of wine with other parents in our hotel rooms at out-of-town events. It progressed to making sure that I hung out with the other parents who I knew drank, who wouldn't judge me for ordering a glass of wine at team mealtimes or for bringing my own vodka to my hotel room. But my disease kept progressing, and in the end, I found myself hiding my liquor. I would sit in my car on the hill above the high school soccer field, watching soccer games from there alone, so I could drink and wait for my son to drive us home. In all these events, there were other parents drinking too, even up on the hilltop. This enabled me to justify my drinking. I told myself that there was nothing wrong with my actions if other parents were doing it too. It didn't occur to me that this behavior was odd, and most people could attend children's activities without having to bring a flask of alcohol with them. The bottom came for me 3 months later, after I'd walked in my first AA meeting. I had not been successful with staying sober for more than a week or two at a time because I was working the program my way. I was doing the steps or calling my sponsor. My bottom was ugly. I humiliated myself and my family by my drunken actions at Mardi Gras. I ended up in a treatment and came to realize that I could not stay sober without the help of the program. It took a few weeks, but I finally surrendered. I became willing to make AA and sobriety my number one priority, placing it even above my children. I learned that my kids would prefer to have neither of their parents at their extracurricular events as opposed to a drunk parent. I realized I had not been successful in hiding my drinking from them, that I had hurt them, and that they didn't trust me. I had ruined my relationships with them. They cut me out of their lives even as I gained some sobriety. I missed almost all my children's activities for the first 9 months of my sobriety because I went from treatment to halfway house more than 250 miles away. During this time, however, I immersed myself in the program. I followed the directions of my sponsor and therapist. I trusted the old-timers who promised me that all I needed to do was work the steps and do the next right thing, and that eventually my kids would want me to be a part of their lives again. There were many false starts and a few setbacks to rebuilding the relationships with my children. At times, I wasn't sure there was any hope. I wanted to give up, but I saw other families experience healing. I wanted what they had, and I had no choice other than to trust my more experienced peers. About a year into my sobriety, a pivotal opportunity came when my son, who has a rising star in high school, asked me to take him on a road trip to look at several colleges. The trip was successful even though we spent many long hours in silence in the car. I honored his desire to not talk about any of our issues, neither my drinking nor my sobriety. This trip led to others, and he and I ended up spending many hours driving across the southeast to look at different campuses and speak to admissions officers. I worked on making living amends to him. Our relationship began to grow. It was a slow and painful process for both of us, but each trip brought us a little closer and offered a new opportunity to begin building a brand new relationship. It took over a year for any of my children to want to spend time with me, a full year, and that was just the first child. To fully regain the trust and respect of all four of my children took almost 4 years. Today, I know that nothing is more important to my children than my sobriety, and the best way I can support them is to be a sober parent. I know that no amount of volunteering, cheering, or being the team mom will matter if I'm not sober. I've made amends and worked the ninth step with each of them. I strive for balance in my life. I love AA, and I make 3 to 5 meetings a week. I'm involved with service work and keep myself fit spiritually and physically. I'm so grateful for the second chance with my children. Our relationships still have their challenges, but with the help of the program and my peers, I'm better prepared for all these milestones. I know that I would have none of this if it weren't for AA. Signed, Janice D. in Daphne, Alabama. And that's all the time we have for the AA Grapevine. You've been listening to the February 2025 issue of the Grapevine. This has been part two. Thank you for listening. My name is Shelley Miller, and I've been your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.